The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Chris Difford. Welcome to my podcast, I Never Thought It Would Happen, brought to you with my friends at Help Musicians. Help Musicians is a wonderful charity that has been supporting artists for 100 years now. It supports all types of music creators throughout the UK, including retired musicians. They offer everything from mental health support to training, mentoring, and brand new projects. Over the coming weeks, I'll be joined by many of my favourite musician friends to chat about the many ways of making music, from the highs to the lows, and everything in between. In this episode, I'll be joined by a young singer-songwriter born in Chichester, just down the road from me on the South Coast. He has won many awards, including a Brit's Critics' Choice and an Ivor Novello for songwriting. We have much in common, although I have to say, I've never been on stage with the Rolling Stones. Please welcome Tom O'Dell. Hi Tom, how are you?
Oh, Chris, how you doing?
Nice to see you and welcome to I Never Thought It Would Happen, which is a podcast I'm doing for Help Musicians. How's things going, Tom?
Good. I've just set up this studio over the past month or so, and it's been amazing to have my own space. I mean, I've had my own space for a while, but it's never been this big before.
Do you find it a creative space to be in?
I mean, I've only done a week's worth of work here, but I would say that, I guess from recording over the past 10 years, I've worked out what I want, and I've been able to set it up in the exact way that's like convenient to me. I've got the microphones I like on the piano, and it's permanently plugged in. I've got the microphone I want, and it's all just quite easy, and trying to capture the ideas when they first come, rather than capturing the ideas on my iPhone and then waiting 6 months to record it and then have to recapture that magic. I want to try and capture it as it's written, because I find the recording process incredibly laborious, and most of the time you're just trying to get back to that original thought or idea or that magic that was there.
So when you were at home many years ago, when you were like 14, 15, how easy was it to capture the magic then?
I had this little dictaphone, one of those sort of Yamaha dictaphones. I used to carry that around with me everywhere. But I think I was much less reliant upon technology then.
What was it like when you were like at home in your bedroom? Did you have a setup like you do now?
No, I think I was about 16 when my grandfather bought me a laptop. 15 or 16, and I installed Logic onto it. So yeah, around that age I got into using Logic and just had it up in my bedroom and really became actually quite obsessed with, that was the point, I became obsessed with making songs and recording them, and it felt so sort of like mysterious, making music and recording, and I'd play the recordings to my aunt and parents and friends and stuff, and I was mind blown that I could sort of create anything. It was just like, you know.
So describe that room. Did you have like posters on the wall and a record player, that sort of thing? How did it look?
I didn't have a record player. First of all, I was in my bedroom, and that's just like a sort of small room with a that's way too small to have a double bed in it. But my parents donated the double bed when they got a new one, and didn't really have a lot in it.
That's weird, sleeping in your parents' bed, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. I think it did freak me out a little bit. It was a cost-effective hand-me-down, but slightly morally questionable one.
Yeah.
That was, I don't know, sort of carpet. The carpet used to scratch my feet. It used to sort of itch my feet. It used to annoy me. The walls were incredibly thin. I could hear everything my sister was doing.
How old was she at the time?
2 years older than me.
Right.
We didn't get on very well at that point.
Why was that? Was she having fellas round?
Yeah, I'd say so. And she didn't really appreciate me playing the piano. It was quite a small house I grew up in. It was sort of the type of house, you know, like a child would draw, you know, like two windows either side of the front door and two windows, you know, above it with a chimney. So very typical in a cul-de-sac. And in one of the rooms downstairs, I had a piano, which my grandparents bought me. And I used to spend a lot of time playing that when I could. Not so much at night, but, you know, in the day when I get back from school. And it was actually many years later I realised how noisy it was. You heard it everywhere. You heard it down the street. The noise travelled. You know, there was no escaping the sound of the piano.
Were your parents supportive of the noise travelling down the street?
Yes, I think they were, actually. And they put up with a lot of it. Every night, my mum told me the other day, she was like, every night you come back and play for an hour or two at least. Very cathartic. And I'd never sing, though. Always just play and hum, because I didn't want them to hear me sing. I was very embarrassed singing. And I'd only sing once I saw the car go down the street, once I knew everyone was out the house. Then I would sing loudly.
So were you quite shy?
For some reason, I was really embarrassed about singing. I don't know why.
That's certainly changed.
Yeah. Although I think if you were to ask me to sing in front of, on that same piano, it's still there, in the same room, I think I would still find it very difficult to do. And yet, you know, I can sing. Well, I spend my entire past 10 years just singing in front of people.
What was the sort of music that was kind of making things happen for you at that time? What were you finding your inspiration in listening to?
I got LimeWire when I was 15, probably. It's quite weird. If I think back, I was probably like the first generation of teenagers that grew up with the internet. You know, we had family friends who were older friends. You know, they were like 18 when they first got the internet. I was 12 or 13. It was dial-up, and then maybe a couple of years later, there was maybe some form of sort of broadband, which meant you could download. But I remember with the dial-up, I would sit there for half an hour to download a song. And then once it sped up, you could download more songs. And I just spent all of my time on the internet just downloading songs illegally from LimeWire. And what was amazing about it is that it meant I was completely off-grid in terms of, I didn't care when it was made. It was just irrelevant to me. I didn't even know when it was made. I didn't have a date. And I would just download sort of people's entire catalogues that they had on their computers. And so I was really into 70s music, probably ultimately. I was obsessed with, you know, Elton. And then through him, you know, got into Leon Russell. And
great. Yeah.
Then anyone that played the piano I was interested in. So
the record shops that were in Chichester you kind of didn't hang out in?
No, not at all. No, I'm not even sure there was. I mean, there was a HMV.
Oh, was there?
Yeah, there was. But maybe a bit later there was a HMV.
Was there a live music scene around Chichester at that point?
Not that I was aware of.
No. So where did you go to see your first live show, as it were?
I didn't really. I didn't see many live shows, which is probably why they became so alluring. You know, it was so unavailable to me. I'd go to Brighton to see live gigs, and I started doing that when I was 16. I started getting involved in some form of scene through my school, and then through friends of the school, actually through some of the music teachers at the school, and, you know, played at some fetes and then in some pubs from the age of 16, and, you know, really saw myself as a piano player in bands and wrote the songs and played the piano, and then always looking for a singer to sing the songs. You know, and then at school I was just in so many bands. I mean, I was just always starting bands, always in the practice rooms. And
if you went to Brighton, what kind of music would you go and see?
I mean, I can't, you know, I went to see largely sort of like small bands that I can't seem to remember the name
any of.
Any
of the names?
Radiohead? not no one big.
No. Well, they wouldn't have been big then. But
I went to see Razorlight in Brighton.
Yeah.
And then, strange, because Andy, the drummer's one of my very dear friends now, I remember that was quite influential because I was quite blown away by Johnny Burrell's stage presence.
God, they're lively. Lively band to watch.
He had his shirt off and sort of like found it quite sort of, wow, this is rock and roll, you know. No, I didn't see like that much live music when I was young. I didn't have access to it. And bless my mum, like, she did take me as much as possible to gigs.
You have to excuse my dog, by the way.
What kind of dog is it? Is
he? It's a Grand Basset Vondine, which is a posh name for a hound. It's a puppy, but it's got like the deepest voice. It sounds like Lou Reed when it barks.
It does. It does.
I'm going to have to shut that dog up if I can. Do you still have anything memorabilia-wise from your bedroom, from your original house?
Well, yeah, this keyboard here. So this keyboard, it's a Roland FP4. I've had it since I was 15, and I had it in my bedroom. And when I moved to Brighton, I dragged it around Brighton, around every pub in Brighton. I think it's been in every single pub in Brighton.
town as well, Tom.
Yeah, I used to have this enormous case for it, and I'm convinced I've got back problems now because of it. It sort of broke a couple of years ago. I mean, it's a piece of crap, really. I mean, it's like, you know, they're not really particularly pricey. I picked one up for a few hundred quid, and it's covered in scratches, but it does have sentimental value to me.
Of course, yeah. Well, that's important. It's important.
Written a lot of songs on it, and always do seem to sit down on it, and always something seems to come.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah, no, it is. Jules has still got the original piano that Squeeze toured with, which was called an RMI piano. I don't know if you've heard of those.
No, I haven't.
But it used to look just like that piano there, and it used to weigh a ton, so I remember lugging it around in the back of vans with Jules. So, yeah, when did the songwriter arrive for Tom? When did he walk in the room and start writing songs?
I mean, honestly, like, probably, like, a ridiculously precocious age of 10. I started writing melodies when I was 10, and I make up entire sort of melodies, and they'd have very simple lyrics to them, like, you know, that contain sort of moon and stars, and that sort of, like, was really what I spent most of my time on the piano doing, was making up melodies. I wasn't actually, and still I'm not very interested in playing other people's music, which is, I guess, somewhat sort of self-indulgent.
Although I've seen you play other people's music. I mean, one of the first times we met, you came to a music night that I was hosting in a little tea room, I think it was, and you played some wonderful versions of Beatles songs and...
Did I?
Stone songs. Gosh. Yeah, it was. You blew me away.
Really? That's such a vague memory to me, that tea room. I don't remember the person I was then, which is strange because, you know, you probably remember things better 12 years ago. It's not that long, is it? But I don't know, it's just like, it just feels, everything before my musical career started I really have problems remembering. I'm not sure why that is, but I don't know if any listeners know, but you were my tutor for a year when I was 18
at BIM.
That BIM.
A music college in Brighton on the south coast. Yeah. I remember meeting you there and thinking that I went home the first night and just thought, that guy Tom, he's the one that stands out of everybody in this room.
Oh, wow.
Apart from there was a very good-looking girl who was in the room as well, which you seemed to have eyes on at the time.
Probably.
But the thing about BIM that I found very odd was the book that we had to teach from, because it said things like how to coil a guitar lead and stuff like that. And I thought, if people are here to learn songwriting, they probably know how to do that already.
Yeah. Well, you hoped.
How did you find your experience of BIM? Do you think it was a worthwhile a year?
I think, honestly, and this is, I hope you know I'm not being sycophantic. I mean, like, you know, there was a couple of tutors, you being one of them, that were hugely inspiring for all of our students. You know, like, there was a real excitement and expectation for your classes. But, you know, because your classes were great, and also because you'd done what we were all there to try and learn how to do, which is incredibly, it was incredibly exciting, you know, when I found out you were teaching.
But I've always wrestled with the thing that you can't teach it. You can't teach songwriting or ambition. It has to be like a seed that comes from within. And there was
you didn't try to, though, and that's what was good. I don't know if I've ever said this, but there was one thing you told me, or that has stuck with me all these years, and I always refer to, is you said that when you couldn't write, when you had some writer's block, you walk along the promenade of Brighton, or you go for a walk. I might be misquoting you, by the way, but this is how the quote's developed in my head over years. And you walk past somebody, and just by walking past them, you look at them, you imagine their entire lives, the story of their life, and that's enough just to spark a new idea in your head. And it's really interesting, because I've done that so many times, to try and get in someone else's skin, get out my own head, you know, when there's nothing going on there.
That's because we're thieves. We're songwriting thieves. Magpies is what we are.
Yeah.
When did ambition first get under your belt? When did you just think, right, this is it, I'm off?
Probably the day I arrived in Brighton. I was renting this little bed sit, and it was an absolute shithole. And I sort of looked in it, and I was like, we're not going to stay here for long. And I really, really wanted to... I don't know. I was, you know, when I was a teenager, before that, I was not ambitious. It really did overnight switch on. I was leaving school and moving out and being in this bed sit, and you know, I just had that keyboard in there and a bed and a small stove, and I just wanted it suddenly, and I felt confident, and far more confident than I should have done, because there was such a long way to go. But you know, if I'm being really honest with you, and I say this with absolute honesty, is I've always felt like I'm not naturally gifted. And I always felt that I had to do more than everybody else. Ever since I started doing this, like, that was always the feeling I had, is that with, like, the lyrics or the melody or the songs, I'd always spend more time than... I could never live with accepting sort of second best. It always had to be the best. And I was terrified of failure. I think so much of that drive, and it is, I think at times has been an insatiable drive, of which it's achieved, like, modest results. But, you know, like, I think, if I'm being honest, that same drive has delivered some... You know, I do have a career in music, but it's also been incredibly destructive.
So do you feel sometimes that you're on the side of your own stage, watching yourself?
Sometimes, yeah.
I mean, you seem very natural to me when I've watched you, and particularly in the recent years when you're up on top of pianos all over the world and guiding the audience into your soul. I mean, you've got a very natural way of appealing to your audience.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you. I think that's come from practice, though. You know, like, I don't think that was a natural thing. I think that's come from doing it so much. And I was fortunate that when my music took off, it did so in a very international way, which meant that we could tour all year round. And not ever playing arenas or anything, but playing theatres and... in America, smaller, and I loved touring. I really loved touring from the moment I did it. And for the first 6 or 7 years of my career, I didn't stop, you know, only ever stopped for a month. And I think just doing it loads have got a confidence on stage now, but I just certainly didn't have that at the start. But I think from playing the piano and singing from a very early age, and that bit does feel natural, and I think that's what I can rely upon.
I mean, you've hung out with lots of wonderful people, you know, like Elton and Lily Allen, people like that. Do you feel that they've got sort of this natural gift that you've been sort of looking for?
I think Elton's certainly got... I mean, the thing that Elton always... like, I've interviewed him a few times, and the thing that always strikes me is that blows my mind is he wouldn't touch the piano for months. You know, he'd go off and do Goodbye, Get a Bit Road for 2 weeks, write it, record it, and then, you know, go shopping for 3 months and then wouldn't practice at all, and then just walk on stage at Wembley or somewhere and just do some sort of iconic performance. I mean,
I know that feeling, though. I like to rehearse in the car.
Yeah, I mean, me too. I mean, certainly I'm not by any means. I fucking hate rehearsing so much. But but then he has got Bernie, you know? So
yeah,
half the job is done for him.
What a wonderful thing. I've always wanted to be Bernie Taupin.
Yeah.
What a great job.
Great job. I mean, it's so great. They just reduce each other's workload. I mean, I'm always so envious because doing the performing, the music and the, you know, the lyrics is, it's a hell of a lot of work.
Really? Do you struggle lyrically then? It doesn't seem like it.
I wouldn't say it flows out of me. I'd say that I spend a lot of time on lyrics and take a lot of care of them. I wouldn't say I, you know, necessarily need help with it, but I like take a lot of time with it. To get a good lyric takes a while for me. Yeah.
Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
Alongside our weekly guests, in each episode, we'll be meeting other musicians from around the UK who've been supported by Help Musicians during these turbulent and troubling times during COVID. The charity has provided over 21,000 musicians with financial hardship support. These beneficiaries are singers, songwriters, composers from rock and pop and classical. And they're all here to tell their story.
Hey, I'm Galia, and I am a pop artist, writer, and producer, and I'm based in Liverpool. My dad always loved music, but he never just had the opportunity to do it. So he encouraged me to do it from kind of quite a young age, and I learned the piano when I was 10. So when I was about 13, I picked up guitar and started writing some songs, and they were like really basic at that time, but it was Taylor Swift at the time. I loved her, she's an absolute queen. I used to watch YouTube videos of her like playing in front of all these crowds. I just thought, that's what I want to do. I want to play to people and I want them to connect with it. I went to university, LIPPA it's called, the Liverpool Institute for Performing Arts, which is Paul McCartney's university. I graduated, and the day before my graduation, I had a songwriting session like one-to-one with Sir Paul McCartney, which was insane. Hearing Paul McCartney sing my songs back to me as well was just nuts. It was amazing. And then I graduated the next day, and then I got out of uni and was like gigging, that was my living. And then almost overnight, really, it was maybe in the space of like a week, 90% of all of my work just vanished, completely vanished. I wasn't eligible for any government grants, which was just an absolute like heartbreaking moment. You know, I felt like I was being punished for trying to like chase my dreams and, you know, do music for a living. And Help Musicians gave me the £500 grant. And then following that, I had a monthly payment from them, which meant that, you know, it covered my bills and it just really, really like gave me that support. And it, more than anything, I'd say that it gave me time as well, because I was trying to like get myself sorted and trying to piece together little bits of work where I could. But obviously there was not really a lot going and still isn't in that scene. And it's just like, I'm so grateful to Help Musicians for the support. So, so grateful. It gave me some time. It was so, so beneficial, and I don't know what I'd have done without it. It's one of those like scary situations where you've got to be so grateful that it happened, but if it hadn't have happened, I don't know what I'd have been doing at that point. I don't know how I'd have got through it. If you can get support from anywhere, take it. You don't be ashamed to admit that you need help. And I know I felt like such a failure for that first part of kind of needing assistance from help musicians, and it was that support that got me through it. That's what it's there for. That's what help musicians are there for, to help you get through a tough situation. That's what they are for.
Help Musicians is a charity for music creators of all genres across the UK, providing a lifetime of support when it's needed most. To find out how they can help you, or to support their work, find them on all social media platforms or visit helpmusicians.org.uk. Can you remember the first time you heard yourself on the radio? I remember, for instance, the first time I heard one of our songs on the radio. It was on the John Peel session, and I was jumping up and down with joy. I just thought, wow, we're on the radio.
Yeah, amazing feeling. Yeah, I was in my flat in East London, and it was just Marianne Hobbs played a song of mine, Can't Pretend. I remember. Couldn't believe it. It's like, to be honest, I was like, I'm ready to retire at that point. I've done all I need to do here.
Once the PRS check was in, you were ready to retire.
Yeah. No, but I still feel like that now. I feel very grateful to get any support from anybody, and feel that giddiness at any achievement is still very, very grateful for, and still put the same amount of work into it as I did then, if not more. You know?
That's amazing. That is totally brilliant. I mean, what would you say in your career so far has been like one of the lowest points where you've just thought, you know what, I think I'm going to become a plumber?
Every morning. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? I mean, my mates who do the same job, it's such a roller coaster. One does feel at points that you're unstoppable, you know, and this is all in one day. You know, in the morning you feel unstoppable, you've just written something that you think is going to change the world, and then 3 hours later you find out the song wasn't going to get playlisted, and it's like, you know, and you're like, well, why the fuck do I do this? Like, but those real low moments, I've never considered giving up. I can't imagine ever doing anything else than this job. It's the only thing I'm really actually any good at.
That's great.
And I think a low point for me was probably when I began making this new album, Monsters, and I was really crippled with anxiety.
Oh,
and
my God.
Just having these panic attacks almost every day, and I was in Los Angeles on my own, pretty much. You know, I had a few friends over there, but sort of only a couple, you know. And I was renting this little house off Abbot Kinney in Venice, and I was just really lonely, really sad. And, you know, I'd broken up with my previous girlfriend a year and a half before, but it just sort of, it was just all accumulated in this one moment. And I just, the sad thing about mental health is it becomes self-perpetuating and inescapable. And yeah. I felt, I was beginning to feel like, didn't matter where I run, it was chasing me. And you know, I was trying to sort of like write, and I was trying to start recording, and couldn't sleep. So I was taking Valium and drinking too much, and just in not a good place, you know. I'd sit on Santa Monica Beach and just look at the planes taking off down at LAX and just dream of being on one, and yet I couldn't leave. I don't know why, I just couldn't leave. And anyway, ended up eventually leaving and coming home and having to stop for a bit and just take a bit of a breather. And yeah. And but yeah, it wasn't a nice time. It was like, and it got out of hand, you know. It got far too dark than it needed to, you know. Yeah. You know?
Yeah. So you've touched the cloth of darkness, as they say.
Yes.
And strangely enough, so have I, and even stranger, in the same part of the world.
Really?
Yeah, Squeeze were recording an album called Play in Los Angeles, and I decided to live on my own down at Venice Beach, you know, in an apartment.
Wow.
And I used to drink and drive, and I found myself one night driving down the freeway the wrong way. And I got chased by Mexicans in a car. I mean, it was just like horrendous, and I don't remember much about that. But when I flew home, everything changed.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so amazing. It's so strange that in the same place, it was, Venice.
It was. Well, Los Angeles can be like that. If you're in the mood for depression, it's a good place to be.
Yeah.
So what would be like the opposite end of that, like your peak experience, an experience where you go, wow, this is like the thing I've been dreaming of?
I mean, winning the Ivan Novello was a big deal for me, only because I felt as if it was validation from my peers and no, my heroes actually, and that felt like good pat on the back. More than that, I just felt it just really made me up that for a bit, and I still feel proud of that today. And it was a while ago now, you know, but I just felt like proud of that. And I'm also hesitant to sort of mention, you know, awards being the thing that provide you sort of.
But it's more than an award, isn't it? Because it's, you're being respected, as you say, by people that are heroes of yours and peers. And the Ivan Novellos, there's nothing greater for a musician, songwriter to get an award like that.
Mm, I agree. Yeah, because the thing with the Brits, it's like, you know, I think it's a little bit of like, it's an extension of the PR, really, isn't it? It's like the labels sort of gain. I mean, not to undermine anyone that's won a Brit Award, but, you know, it feels...
It's a bit Woolworths, I think.
Yeah. Although, you know, I wouldn't turn one down, but...
I will never get one, but I understand. But, such a palaver, though, isn't it, the Brits these days? It's like a Hollywood... You have to put on dancers all over the place and...
Yeah.
You can't just turn up and play the piano like you would love to do, I don't think.
It's very sort of corporate, isn't it? Isn't it sponsored by MasterCard or something? You know,
yeah,
it's like...
Yeah.
You know, I'm very grateful for the Brits because they actually did, you know, I did win that Critics' Choice thing at the start of my career, and that was, that really helped things move along, but the bastards haven't given me an award since.
So in the time that you've been touring and releasing records and stuff, how do you feel the music industry has changed for you, and do you think it's in a good place for people like yourself?
I mean, it's changed so much in, I guess, the sort of 10 years I've been working within it, almost unrecognisable to what I entered. I think I entered possibly at a point that it was having a sort of identity crisis. With some perspective and now, I feel it was certainly struggling to sort of, you know, monetize music, and they were unsure about what the future was, and I feel like now there is more concrete mechanics in what the future looks like. And I think the future is, you know, streaming and social media, and I actually think it's incredibly liberating for many artists, and I think it's doing lots of positive things for music in the fact that it's less dictated by institutions such as radio and journalists, and it's put the power back to the people in, to some extent. And very interesting what it's doing to pop music. I think pop music's in such a fertile, fascinating place that I find to be very exciting, you know, when you've got people like Billie Eilish putting songs out, like, you know, her previous single, Your Power, which is a song about, like, abuse and... Yeah, this is called pop music. This is amazing, you know, that we're living through a time of such diversity and lyrical content. And I think, you know, people like Travis Scott and all these almost prog rock rappers, like, what they're doing to music is stunning and super inspiring for people like me. But obviously, I think the fact that the streaming model is not also working.
No,
financially.
Financially, yeah, it's pretty grim for a lot of people.
Very grim, and, you know, but, like, I think that needs to be fixed, but I think I'm not just going to bash it as well, because I think it's done a hell of a lot of positive things for people.
It has, it's opened up, it's become, like, the shop window for a young songwriter is no longer 6x6, it's kind of like the worldwide. It's like
Exactly,
it's like Harrods.
TikTok's interesting as well, I think. Very interesting what it's doing to popular music
What does it mean for the album?
The album's done, I think.
Oh, really? Okay.
I don't know. I try not to get too sort of like hysterical with these things, but like, I think maybe it will never go the album. I think people want long form, deep dives into artist work. But I think what's interesting is lots of young artists that are coming up, like Griff and, you know, Arlo Parks and so many new artists. They take so long to put their first album out, and you can get so far now without doing it. And just the way streaming works, I have to say, having spent 2 years just making a record and slaving over it, it is to be listened to as a record. But I have to say, like, there's moments I do feel that it's beginning to become out of touch doing that, going away for 2 years making a record. I more feel the future is to just keep making pieces of music and keep putting it online and you engage with your audience. And even radio is beginning to become, to me, just like, you know, my younger friends, do any of them listen to the radio? They just listen to Spotify.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the album has become like sliced bread, really. It's like you never have the whole loaf, you just have one slice at a time.
Yeah.
That's okay. I mean, that's progress in many, many ways. Have you heard of Help Musicians?
Yeah, so peripherally.
They've been going for 100 years now. It was started by Edward Elgar and Vaughan Williams. Wow. It was a way of helping friends of theirs who didn't have any money in the orchestra, who were sort of on hard times. And in the last year, they've given out like £17 million to musicians who have been basically on their arse during the pandemic. Do you think there's empathy in the music industry?
Ooh, that's a broad question. What, for amongst musicians or amongst sort of the businessmen and the
musicians? It's a very difficult question to ask, I guess, because we all know that the businessmen are not that empathetic for the people further down the food chain.
Not famously.
But, you know, us as musicians, we have to reach out to each other and hold each other during tough times, I guess.
100%, yeah. I think that, yeah, certainly. I mean, I've tried to do that during the pandemic as much as I can with those musicians that I work with predominantly, you know, and have done over the years. I would like to think that most musicians want to help each other out. I think we're sensitive souls.
We are.
Predominantly, and so tend to try and look after those around us. Being a solo artist, I've always felt a duty to look after my band as much as possible and the crew, and try to do as much as I can there. I mean, I did a couple of live streams and give them the money from them and did that. I don't know how much it helped, but maybe it helped a little bit. But the thing that I just wish I could do is I wish I could do another tour. You know, as much as like financial handouts are one thing, but it's having the work. The work is the thing that people want. They want to work. They want to get out of the house. They want to feel good about themselves. And, you know, that's certainly something I wish I could give them more.
Who do you lean on?
As a sort of...
emotionally?
My girlfriend.
Great. Good answer.
Probably a little bit too much.
It's the toughest job in the music industry, being the girlfriend or a wife of a musician.
Yeah, certainly.
Especially once, you know, I find as a songwriter, and you probably find this too, that when you're off in your imagination trying to write a song, you can be very distant with the one that you're with. They say, well, what are you doing looking out the window? And you say, I'm writing a song. Mm. And they don't understand.
No, I know. It's also, I think, it's an elusive job to have, and one that I think mostly I find, I might be being presumptuous, but I think most, certainly you and I, or most songwriters that are in it for the same reasons, we tend to have to go to the studio. I have to go, I sit down, I do, you know, I put a sort of working day in. I don't know if you do the same.
It's important to be Tom. I mean, you get up in the morning, you want to be Tom.
Exactly, yeah. And it sometimes people find it difficult. It's like, well, why don't you just come to the pub? It's like, because you can, you know. It's like, well, I know I can, but I'm going to sit here at this piano for another 3 hours and torture myself, and then I'm going to come to the pub.
It's great, Tom, that you've got that discipline. That's exactly what you need as a writer, I think. You need a discipline to say, this is who I am.
Certainly, yeah. I don't think I would have or could get anything done without it. I think the discipline is certainly one of the most important attributes, yeah.
Tom, thank you so much for your time.
Absolute pleasure. So nice to catch up with you and see you. I'd love to see you in real life.
We're waiting for the sweet shop to open. There's a great queue of musicians waiting for the sweet shop to open.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
very much. Yeah, appreciate you having me on as well.
Hey, God bless you, Tom. See you soon.
Yeah, take care, man.
Bye. It was so great to have Tom O'Dell on my podcast. What a nice chap he is. I feel extremely blessed to have conversations like this. I'm full of admiration for a man who can stand on top of a piano. I often think to myself, if I stood on top of a piano, it would probably collapse. So thank you so much, Tom, for showing us the way. Thanks for listening to I Never Thought It Would Happen with me, Chris Difford. You can find out more about Help Musicians at www.helpmusicians.org.uk. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast and please leave us a review, hopefully a good one. We'd love to know what you think and who you'd like us to feature in future shows. See you on the next episode and keep coming back. I Never Thought It Would Happen is a Gimme Sugar production for Help Musicians.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.